So welcome again, everyone. We're glad you're here. We're covering three topics in the middle of this conversation. One is what gives life meaning. One of the great challenges facing the human race is to think about that and understand that. How to live together, given our cultural differences. That was yesterday. And then today, how we will live as a part of Earth's ecosystem while respecting it and future generations. And so we're going to do a little setup for that this morning. Adam's going to do that, and then Johanna and Adam and I will do some reflections on that from each of our traditions. We'll reflect briefly on what we appreciated about each other's presentations and kind of thoughts. And then we'll open it up for you to have some conversation in threes about what you heard and how you felt, and then kind of frame a question or two that you might share with the group. And so we're just grateful y'all are here in a nice, cool, sunny morning. So, Adam, would you be willing to give us the setup for how we will live as a part of Earth's ecosystem?
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
The topic is, how will we live as a part of the Earth's ecosystem while respecting it and future generations? Earth Day Overshoot happened on August 1st, 2018. This is the day when the human race uses the amount of resources that the Earth can sustain on a yearly basis. We are using 1.7 Earths, according to the Global Footprint Network's website. We use more ecological resources and services than nature can regenerate through overfishing, overharvesting, and emitting more carbon dioxide into the atmosphere than ecosystems can absorb. We have been witnessing fires in California that are creating their own weather system and leaving firefighters uncertain what to do. We are seeing the thawing of the permafrost and fires in the Arctic. The carbon dioxide and methane in the permafrost will amplify the carbon dioxide produced through human activity. In the last weeks, we have seen the heartbreaking photos of Tahlequah, the grieving orca mother whose calf died. She carried her calf around in what appears to be an act of grief. Her grief was shared, it seems, as others in her pod took turns pushing the calf through the water. The death of this calf is especially sad as the calf was a female. The pressure on these orcas due to diminishing fish stocks is representative of the estimated 30,000 species being driven to extinction each year, as estimated by Harvard biologist E.O. Wilson. The World Bank found that 140 million people could be forced to move within the boundaries of their own countries by 2050. A UN study estimated that between 25 million and 1 billion people may be forced to move to other countries because of climate change. The most often cited number is 200 million. Can the human race, now comprised of 7.5 billion people, vast and complex economic systems and competing interests, live within a way that allows for the thriving of other species, our children, and the Earth's ecosystem? And the last line, Harriet, and you have the last line.
What do Abrahamic faith traditions have to offer this conversation? So just take a moment. Thank you, Adam. And just take a moment and think about how you feel about that and what you think about that topic. Again, just noticing your emotions especially. So Rabbi, would you begin?
Absolutely. And I have the blue papers, our texts for today, if someone wants to hand those out. So as with my two other presentations, I'm approaching answering these very important and critical questions from the perspective of what does Jewish wisdom from the course of Jewish history have to offer in answering these questions. And today, we're going to begin with the answer of our tradition helps us understand our place in creation. That we will live more harmoniously in creation when we understand our place and role in creation. And the first text comes from an early medieval commentary on the Torah, and it asks, why was only a single specimen of man or human created first? To teach us that he who destroys a single soul destroys a whole world, and he who saves a single soul saves a whole world. Furthermore, no race or class may claim a nobler ancestry, saying, our father was born first, and finally, to give testimony to the greatness of the Lord, who caused the wonderful diversity of mankind to emanate from one type. And then the environmental piece is, and why was Adam created last of all beings? to teach him humility. For if he be overbearing, let him remember that the little fly preceded him in the order of creation. In a dispute, therefore, as to which biblical verse expresses the fundamental principle of the law, Shimon ben Azai maintained against Rabbi Akiva, who, following Hillel, had singled out the golden rule, that the principle of love must have as its basis Genesis 5:1, which teaches that all men are the offspring of him who was made in the image of God. So what is our place in creation? That we are all descended humanity from a single origin, and that we were created last in the order, and we should always know our place as to what and who was created before us in the creation of all things. And in our tradition, we do not read this text. We don't read the Torah literally. We believe in evolution. So this is really not about whether this is a scientific analysis. We believe in climate change and global warming. But this text helps us remind us how to get us out of this situation. What can lead us out? What is the wisdom that will lead us out? And part of it is understanding that we are interconnected. And if one little species of fly dies somewhere and becomes extinct, that could affect the whole. That's how things are made fundamentally, interconnected. The second story, the second midrash, story about a story in the Bible, says that God showed Adam around the Garden of Eden and said, "Look at my works, see how beautiful they are, how excellent. For your sake I created them all. See to it that you do not despoil or destroy my world, for if you do, there will be no one else to repair it." So this is, and these texts, this one particularly probably comes from around the year 200 of the Common Era, meaning 200 years after the year zero, is when it was written down. It might have been an oral story that we told about the Torah for a long time, but this idea that we are the ones who could break it, we're also the ones who can repair it, but no one else is going to repair it, and God isn't going to repair it for us. This is a one-time shot here. Here you go. See what you do with this beautiful creation. You break it, you fix it. And up at the top of the right-hand side of the page, this is from the Babylonian Talmud, the section called Brachot, Blessings. Anyone who enjoys of the natural world without a blessing, it is as if he has enjoyed from that which is sanctified for heaven. And I'm not going to get into the rest of the text. It's not as important as the first part, which is there's this notion within Judaism that if you enjoy the fruits of creation without saying a blessing, it's as though you're stealing from God. That you're not acknowledged, that without the lack of acknowledgement, it's theft. And then right below this text, we have a text from the medieval Jewish commentator, doctor, scholar, Rambam Maimonides in the Mishneh Torah. He writes that the way to come to love and fear God is by contemplating God's amazing words and creations and seeing the infinite wisdom expressed in them. This will bring one to love God and want to praise and glorify God. One will experience tremendous longing and yearning to know God's great name. In the words of David, "My soul thirsts for Elohim, the living power." As one contemplates further on these things, one will immediately recoil in fear and awe, realizing that one is a tiny, lowly creature standing with flimsy wisdom before the one who has perfect knowledge. I was reading this afternoon this wonderful book. Do you ever listen, any of you listen to On Being by Kristen Tibbetts? Yes, of course. This is a good group for On Being. But if you're not, it's a wonderful podcast exploring themes of religion, spirituality, philosophy. She has a great book, interviews that she's done about science and religion. And I was reading an essay today about Darwin and how Darwin and Galileo and many of the philosophers who to rock the socks off of humanity in their revelations were religious people, that they actually, they were, what they were going through in their scientific and spiritual discovery is what Maimonides describes here, is that longing. Darwin was about to become a pastor. He was going to go into the ministry and then had an opportunity to go and go around the world as a naturalist, as a young man, but it was his longing for God and to understand the workings of the universe that led to his to writing Origins of the Species, which he did not publish for 20 years after he wrote it. because he said he did not want to break the like break the hard space of the Christians around him in what he was going to say, which was going to break their idea of the order of the world, which, and this is in the time of like Jane Austen's Victorian times, the world is it's supposed to be, and everything's good, and things don't evolve, they just are, and he was about to disrupt that. If you turn onto the other side of the page, just one here. So far we've talked about understanding our place in the world and our responsibility for the planet as human beings. But the third piece of wisdom I'm bringing is this idea that without awe and regularly experiencing it as human beings, we are lost. We are lost on this planet. So I wanted to share with you some readings. Abraham Joshua Heschel wrote that human beings have indeed become primarily tool-making animals, and the world is now a gigantic toolbox for the satisfaction of their needs. Nature is a toolbox in a world that does not point beyond itself. It is when nature is sensed as mystery and grandeur that it calls upon us to look beyond it. And he also writes, as civilization advances, the sense of wonder declines. Such decline is an alarming symptom of our state of mind. We will not perish for want of information, but only for want of appreciation. And finally, from a European Jewish poet in the 1700s, 1800s, he wrote, "And if you ask me of God, my God, where is God that in joy we may worship? Here on earth too God lives, not in heaven alone, a striking fir, a rich furrow, in them you will find God's likeness, divine image incarnate in every high mountain. Wherever the breath of life blows, you will find God embodied. And God's household, all beings, the gazelle, the turtle, the shrub, the cloud pregnant with thunder, God in creation is God's eternal name." And I just want to leave you on the right-hand side of the page, because so many of the texts I use from our tradition are written by men, because we have not had women writing being published for more than the last maybe 60, 70 years in the way that men were. I wanted to just invite you to learn more about three Jewish environmental feminists who are on the right-hand side, work that Jewish women are doing in this world to help sustain our planet. And just leave you knowing that there are, other than myself, there are a lot of other Jewish women out there in the world thinking and writing and doing. So thank you so much.
Very cool. Thank you so much, Johanna. You're up next, right?
Yeah.
Yes. Thank you so much for such a thoughtful presentation. And actually, the word I saw in Hebrew here, barakat. Is that how do you pronounce it?
This is brachot or bracha.
Like actually, in Arabic, the word for blessing is barakat.
So it's the same,
very
yeah.
similar.
Yeah.
And Barack Obama.
Yes, exactly.
There must be a connection there somewhere. So, okay. So, I guess I'll start with the fact that by 2050, over 60% of the world's population will be Christian or Muslim. So between the Christians and the Muslims, we can have a lot of impact on the world if we understand our faith in the right way. Pope Francis, when writing encyclical about the environment, he says that solutions cannot come from science and technology alone, and that faith will also play a part in how we interact with our environment and the earth. And so when it comes to, I guess I'll just stick to the basics of the perspective of my faith on the earth and the natural world, especially since a lot of people, I think, need just the basics of Islam. I think that I would just, I'll try to stick to that. So in the Quran, which is the holy book of Muslims, there are many verses that talk about this earth. God says in chapter 59, whatsoever is in the heavens and whatsoever is on the earth glorifies God. So everything, whether animate or inanimate, is glorifying God. The stars and the trees prostrate, God says. They prostrate to God in chapter 55. Unto God prostrates whatsoever or whosoever is in the heavens and whosoever is on the earth, the sun, the moon, the stars, the mountains, the trees, and the beasts. There is no thing save that it hymns his praise, though you do not understand their praise. And even Muhammad, peace be upon him, he said that the earth has been created for me as a mosque and as a means of purification. And a mosque in Arabic, the word for mosque in Arabic is masjid. And masjid literally is a place of prostration. So what he is saying is that the entire earth is a place of prostration for me. It is a place that I can pray. When we came here to Holden Village, Chuck and Peg, they were asking us, you need a place to pray. You need a specific thing. And we said, well, actually, we can pray anywhere. We can pray in our rooms. We can pray on the earth. We can pray wherever we want to, as long as it is clean. And also, the earth is a means of purification. So before our prayers, which is a set ritual set of movements a few times a day, five times a day, and when we're traveling, it's three times a day, and it's shorter, so that makes it easier. Before we pray, we actually make ablution, which is a type of washing. So we wash our arms, our face, we wipe water over our hair, and in the absence of water, because many times you might find yourself without water, or rarely nowadays, but especially in the past, especially in the desert, then you can actually simply tap your hands on the earth and symbolically rub them over your arms, and that can be the alternative to the water cleansing. And so using that earth as a means of purification is something that is part of our faith. So there is a sacredness to the earth, which is a fit place for human service of God, whether in formal ceremonies or in daily life. And then also in the Quran, God talks about the whole of nature being assigned for people who hear, for people who reflect, and for people who understand. Do you not observe that God sends down rain from the sky so that in the morning the earth becomes green? And a parallel is drawn between revelation being rain and rain being rain, that when the earth has dried out and become barren, that rain comes and reignites that land and rejuvenates that land in the same way that revelation from God does to the hearts of people. And another thing is that green is a Muslim's favorite color, they say. I don't know exactly where it comes from, but it could be a part of this, that when rain comes down from the sky, it turns things green. And green is a hopeful color, and it is a positive color. And when people see green, studies show that greenery and nature actually is beneficial for the heart, and it's beneficial for the soul, and beneficial for the mind. And so then turning away from this nature and these signs of God is corruption. God says, when anyone turns away from God's signs, he endeavors to work corruption upon the earth, to destroy tillage and offspring, to destroy land and people. And that is because he has turned away from God's signs in the earth. And this corruption is the result of arrogance. God says in the Quran, walk not arrogantly upon the earth. Walk not arrogantly upon the earth. For you will not ascend or transcend the mountains. The mountains are above you. The mountains, as soon as we walk out of our chalets and our lodges, we see these enormous mountains. And we cannot transcend them. We can try to climb them. We can try to hike them. But we will never transcend them. So how can we walk so arrogantly upon this earth? Also in chapter 6, God says about human beings, it is God who appointed you stewards upon the earth and raised some of you by degrees above others that he may try you in that which he has given you. So one of our beliefs in our faith is that this earth, our bodies, the blessings that God has given us, these are a trust from him. He has entrusted us with these things. And so Muslims are encouraged to keep fit because their bodies are a trust that He has given them. And to keep the world around us and to maintain the world around us because it is a trust from God. And even He says in the Quran that we presented the trust. He calls it the trust, the idea of being a steward, the stewardship and being God's representative on this earth. He says, we presented the trust to the heavens, to the earth, and to the mountains. That would you take on this responsibility? And they all declined. And it was man who was then given the stewardship and given this trust. And now I'll give you some examples of stewardship from our texts. And I'll start with a former United States Secretary of the Interior who said that stewardship of the environment was not really such an urgent matter in light of the prophesied destruction of the natural order on doomsday. So because there is a doomsday coming, there's no point in preserving the natural environment. But in contrast, Muhammad, peace be upon him, he said that even if the day of judgment is coming, if someone has a seed in his hand, then he should plant it. So doomsday is coming, and you know it's coming. But even then, if you have a seed in your hand, you should plant it. So that's symbolic to the kind of effort that you should be putting into growing and planting and thinking about the future. And he also said, Muhammad said, there is no person who plants a tree or sows a field for a human bird or animal, but it shall be reckoned as charity from him. And I talked about charity previously, as charity in the Islamic faith is not simply giving wealth, but it is also doing other acts, for example, planting a tree and sowing a field. He also said there are three types of people who God will not talk to nor look at on the day of resurrection. One of the three is a man who withholds his extra water. God will say to him, today I withhold my grace from you as you withheld the extra water which you yourself had not created. And God says in the Quran, corruption appears on land and sea because of the evil which human beings' hands have done. And we see that today on this earth, we see these incredible oil spills that ruin the Gulf, and I'm from Texas, so I know about that, that ruined the Gulf of Mexico, that ruined the water near Alaska because of these tremendous oil spills, because big corporations decide not to follow the regulations as they are meant to, and wrongdoing is found, but unfortunately they're not held accountable for that because of how big they are, and they are too big to fail, unfortunately. Once a companion of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, was performing ablution and using too much water. The Prophet said to him, what is this extravagance? The companion responded, is there extravagance with water? And he said, yes, even if you were on the banks of a flowing river, there is still extravagance. Then he said about animals, he said, do not take any living being as a target. Whoever kills a sparrow or anything bigger than that without a just cause, God will hold them accountable on the day of judgment. The listeners asked, O Messenger of God, what is a just cause? He replied that he will kill it in order to consume it, not simply to kill it and then throw it away. And so animals have a purpose, but beyond that purpose, they should not be taken as a target. And also to remind everyone that in those days, meat was consumed very rarely, even though meat was permissible to the people of faith. It is not something that was consumed almost daily as it is today, and the kind of environmental impact that it has today. And so, in conclusion, I'd say, as a call to action, change starts with ourselves. To not waste food, to not waste water, to reduce our meat consumption because of the effects that, and the methane and the carbon dioxide that is released because of huge meat factories and beef farms. And I'd say the second call to action is to partner with faith allies and to use faith as a reason to come together to lobby on behalf of the environment and Mother Earth. And I'll end with the words of Martin Luther King Jr., who said, "Let's rededicate ourselves to the long and bitter but beautiful struggle for a new world." Thank you so much.
So I want to show you a couple things. So first of all, Martin Luther taught that our God is what we fear, love, and trust. So if I told you that I, as a teaching staff member, I have access to my phone and therefore to my stock app on my phone, what if I told you in the last 2 days, while you guys were not connected to the internet, the stock market dropped 5,000 points? How would you feel about that? Are you a little twinge though? Just a little bit, right? So there's vast inequity in the wealth distribution in the United States. You can see that the poor and those in considered the middle class have a certain amount of wealth, and that the top 1% has a vast much more. In fact, so much more that they can't fit it on the chart. Okay, so in a recent report by Deutsche Bank, they were trying to outline for their partners what were the sources of strife. They called it populism, but really it was civic unrest, is really what they were getting at. And what they found is this, that this is a chart comparing the wealth of the 90%, the bottom 90%, to the top 0.1%. And you can see that somewhere in the mid-1980s, through a combination of tax cuts and offshoring and mechanization, that you see that the top 1% begin to gain a tremendous amount, and the bottom 90% begin to drop in terms of their overall portion of the wealth in this country. And then you can see, if you look at the chart, somewhere around 2005 or so, somewhere in there, of course there's a big drop because of the economic bust, the Great Recession. But it's estimated that 85% of the job losses in manufacturing during the 2000s were due to mechanization and automation and were not due to offshoring. And there are many people saying that this trend of the top 1% having much more is going to be even tremendously increased because instead of needing 400 workers in a factory, you now need 40. And maybe eventually not even that. And so what we're used to understanding in the United States of America is that the way wealth is shared is by people working and having wages. But we'll also see, if I can get it to work, that what we've seen since especially the mid-70s is what's called a decoupling of efficiency, productivity, and hourly compensation for American workers. And so productivity has increased since 1948, 241%, but wages have only increased 112%, and you can see that since the mid-70s, wages have been nearly flat. Meanwhile, while TVs may be less expensive, healthcare and housing and many other things have grown to such a great degree that many folk are experiencing a loss of economic potential and well-being and security. So a couple of economists out there, Angus Deaton and Ann Case from Princeton, say that they're tracking, trying to study the deaths of despair taking place across the country. And what they say is that these deaths of despair are not simply because of economic issues, but they're also because of meaning. People are losing meaning, they're losing a sense of community and a sense of hope for the future. And so folk are committing suicide, they're drinking themselves to death, they're engaged in the opioid epidemic. And so, and in part because I just want to state that I don't think that the primary meaning system of the United States of America and much of the world is Christianity, Judaism, or Islam. The primary meaning system is that we are competitors as producers and consumers in an economy where the market is God. Do I need to say that again? I'm not sure I can. So we are individuals competing as producers and consumers in a market economy who functions in many respects as our God, who is the one that is going to fix everything, but is also capricious, and when things go bad, well, it's just the market, and sometimes the market makes mistakes. And so what we have, because of what's happening in these charts, what's happening in our economy, a lot of people are experiencing a tremendous loss of meaning because they are no longer able to participate in the meaning system as producers and consumers, which is all based on a certain small truth, which is we all need food and clothing and housing to survive. That's a good thing. But we've turned it into something very, very different. And this is especially hitting those with only a high school degree or less. So you can see up here we have the money and earnings of the U.S. population. Those with a bachelor's degree or more are the blue, and those with a high school education or less are the red. And you can see that this chart explains that these folk are going in radically different directions. Somewhere, white people with a high school diploma or less are getting paid about 18% less than they were in the 1980s in another chart that was included. And so we have a lot of people experiencing a lot of disillusionment with the meaning system that they've been given, because we were told that if you work hard, then you will have a lifestyle that is comfortable, and your family will benefit from this. So it's breaking down. So we have a second problem, of course, is that the second issue, of course, is that with 7.5 billion of us on the planet, we may have to actually change our sense of what it means to what kind of lifestyle we're going to live, what it means to have an adequate lifestyle, or even a generous one. And because it's very clear that we're talking about wealth inequality in the United States in these charts, this is not even to mention the wealth inequality between members of the people who live in the United States or the industrialized world and those that don't. And then we, as Adam said, you know, we're using up about 1.7 Earths per year. And we are seeing essentially a kind of a thieving from the future taking place in our quest to live out this meaning system as individuals competing in a market economy as producers and consumers. And of course, we all know stories of those who have succeeded at this and had billions and millions of dollars. I've met some of them in Anacortes as I was pastor there, a place where some millionaires go to live. And sometimes they die there. And often on their deathbed, they recognize that they fought for nothing. Their life was not as meaningful as they might have wished in retrospect. So there is a story in the New Testament that speaks to this. Anthony just did an excellent text study about it an hour ago. So it's the parable of the talents. And so a man is going on a journey and summoned his slaves and entrusted them, one with five talents, one with two, and one with one, according to their ability. And they were supposed to go out and invest and make this work out for them. But one just dug a hole and stuck it in the ground. The master comes back, and says, okay, how'd y'all do? How much more money do I have now? And one says, hey, master, I had five. I got five more. One says, you gave me two talents. I had two more. You got to know that the talent is a whale of a lot of money. Like a super de-duper amount of money. Like something like, I don't know, like a lot. Just say a lot. And so it's a ton. Like most people would never even see a talent in their whole life. It's a lot of money. And so the master comes back and says to the one who buried it in the ground, you know, where's my money? And says, well, here you go. This is what you get. I'm giving you one talent back. And he has a critique of the master, who we as white American Christians often assume is God. Says, well, master, I knew that you were a harsh man, reaping where you did not sow, gathering where you did not scatter seed. So I was afraid. And I went and hid your talent in the ground. Here, you have what is yours. And the master replies, and again, a lot of times we assume this is God because our word talent comes from this. From this story. You wicked and lazy slave, you knew, did you, that I reap where I did not sow and gather where I did not scatter? Notice that the master does not contend. The master says, yeah, that's right. Then you ought to have invested my money with bankers, and on my return I would have received what was my own with interest. Tell me, Rabbi Yohanan, what is the Hebrew Scriptures teaching about interest?
We don't.
We don't.
We don't exact interest from people.
Why not?
It's taking advantage of their situation.
So why is it that good white, you know, good Christians have assumed that the master in the story is God? When no Hebrew person could possibly conceive of God encouraging interest. So in the ancient times, they understood in first century, the peasants understood that the economy was kind of a zero-sum game. There's only so much pie. And if you end up with more pie at the end of your life, you've stolen pie from others. The only way God can bless you to get more wealth is through flocks and crops, because God controls what's in the ground and the fertility of the animals. And so by burying it in the ground, this person with one talent is entrusting it to God, as many people would do after when they went on a trip. They would bury it in the ground because God's in control of what happens in the ground. And if someone comes and takes it, well, then that must be God's will. The ground is like the bank, only with no interest, right? So this story is actually coming in Matthew 25, is a parable of critique about exploitative economic systems that steal from the poor, and not only steal from the poor, but steal from the future. That's what this story is about. And right after it, we have the other story of the parable of judgment, right, that we often call Matthew 25, where there's goats and there's sheep, and Jesus says, and the judge says, those of you who visited me when I was in prison, when I was poor, when I was, you know, come with me, and because if you did it to the least of these, you did it to me. And then the story is reversed. So we have in the Abrahamic tradition, we have two key elements. One is love of God more than tribe and tradition. And in that, care for the ecology is inherent, because how can one love God if one does not love and care for the long-term well-being of what God has made? It is inherent in that core. In love of neighbor, as you love yourself, inherent in that statement is love of neighbor around the world and love of neighbor in the future. But we're in a situation now where I believe we need to make a three-part teaching about the core of the Abrahamic tradition. It may need to be more explicit to say we need to manage our economy equitably within the limits of ecology. To manage the economy equitably within the limits of the ecology. So there's a vision in the New Testament, in the Christian scriptures, in Revelation 21, of a new heaven and a new earth. And the biblical scholar N.T. Wright says This is the moment. This is the vision toward which all of Christian faith moves. That Jesus is inviting all of us to take up our own power, our own decisions, our own life, and bring healing and creation to the little bit of the earth that we can, not only individually, but collectively. To wait for the day when the earth is healed, and to work for the day when the earth is healed. But then there's that new heaven part. What does that mean? Does that mean that God needs to, you know, refurbish God's chambers in heaven so that God can have a brand new, like, earth, a golden footstool or something? No. A new heaven, in this case, is a new imagination for the beauty of the world, for the beauty of our life that we experience, for the beauty of for a new vision for what it means to be human beings. All of us are invited to work for that day when our imaginations are renewed, where our exploitative market system, however we compete in as producers and consumers, can be set aside, and we find a meeting system which not only promotes our own well-being, but in which we see our well-being intimately tied to every creature on this planet, to every person in the future, because the earth is beautiful, because life is beautiful, and because God is moving among us to repair it. I agree with the critique, so I'll stop there, and then we'll talk more. So that's it. Okay, so what do we appreciate about each other?
I appreciate you. As a person.
So Adam, when you talked about the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, saying that if the world is nearing the end and there someone has a seed in their hand, that they should plant it, Martin Luther said, was asked once, if you, Dr. Luther, you know, what would you do if you found out the earth was ending tomorrow? And his response was, like, go plant an apple tree.
Mm-hmm. And we have a story also similar.
Do
to
it.
That. Yeah, that if you're, you know, that a man was planting a tree and he suddenly heard that the Messiah was coming and he finished planting the tree first. So the teaching is finish planting the tree and then go greet the Messiah. So yes, I think I do appreciate that all of our traditions have that. I think that this notion within humanity that the earth is ours to just take, and I think about the Mayan that used to be here, sort of that process of coming and just like deciding we want this and we're going to take it, and it creates wealth for people, and it might have created the origins of settlement and wealth for many people who lived in this area who were workers on the mine. And so we understand the human need for exploration of the planet, but then there's also the responsibility piece. And I think that's where religion comes in, and it's where it's going to be most useful in American society, is especially if all three Abrahamic faiths can get together, we can really turn things around on the environment because we all share common teachings about responsibility. And if all three groups together really push environmental stewardship and sustainability and recovery and redemption of the earth, redeeming it, that we could really make a huge, significant impact for this planet. I think that's possible.
I guess I also have a question. Is what can we as everyday people, what can we do about income inequality in this country?
Yeah, so there's a lot of economists and other people thinking about now that wages and productivity are decoupled, and that it's estimated that 47% of workers in the U.S. this is two Oxford economists saying this, will not be employable by 2025 because automation is coming on board.
2025?
2025, that's what they said.
Yeah, that's in 7 years.
And that might be aggressive. You know, they said it could be, you know, a little later, a little earlier, whatever, but it's already happening. And so there's been talk of a universal basic income. And which I happen to be in favor of. The challenge with it is not, in my opinion, how do we generate enough money for a universal basic income and healthcare and those kind of things, but rather, how will people understand what it means to be human when they no longer derive all of their meaning from work? Which is why I think the all faith traditions, including the three Abrahamic traditions, are going to have to step up to the plate and keep talking about the dignity of human beings in our being because God made us, and then as you know, as part of how do we understand our meaning in the midst of a world where our work is not as necessary? And so we're not talking about a world where people don't work, but where people have the basics, and then they're invited to go work, and some of what they could do if they do not have a master's degree in computer programming, you know, is to go out and repair the earth. And maybe they work 2 weeks out of 8. And they go out and they take part in the cleaning and the healing and restoration of the world. And that allows them the dignity of work and so forth. But it also gives them a little extra money for some of the extras they may want, like, you know, maybe a small iPad that hopefully will be built to last more than 3 years. So there's some ideas out there. But I think the key issue is how do we understand what it means to be human? It really is a theological question, is what people are grappling with, because the theology we've talked about is the theology of the marketplace and the person working and so forth. I don't know. What do you all think?
I don't think the resistance to it is not going to come mainly out of the people articulating, you know, a theology of what it means to be a human being. It's different than that. But you're right though that we've made the system God, you know, that it's antithetical to people's, you know, understanding. I mean, so in a sense it is that, but the people will articulate it in a way that, well, you know, that just goes against everything we understand about how things work or should work, and it's just really hard to imagine that gaining traction unless we also approach it in a way that is also very pragmatic. I mean, we will have to deal with the meaning questions, but we'll have to make an economic case for it, you know, and why this is indeed more practical than, just like the criminal justice, you know, why is it that Alaska and some of the conservative states have gone to, you know, to like some criminal justice reform, not out of moral kind of compulsion, but out of economic, so.
Yeah, so just very, very briefly to say, just one sentence is it's not working.
Right.
The system is breaking down.
Right.
And so the question before a lot of the wealthy folk, like even at Davos, Switzerland, where they get together,
right,
is the pitchforks are coming, baby. Okay, so Deutsche Bank didn't write this report because they're concerned about the poor. Deutsche Bank wrote the report because they're concerned about the system beginning to break down. Because Bill Gates only needs one tube of toothpaste every couple weeks. But what if thousands of people can't afford the toothpaste? So it's the system that it's breaking down. So this is a moment where reflection can kind of come in and help.
Right.
Yeah. Yes.
So there is like two parts. Like the in Germany, this universal universal base income.
Basic income.
Basic income is discussed a little more. Mm-hmm. And if you go back to the Human Rights Bill and say there is a certain base that every human should have, and that you commit as a society that they should have, like, you know, food, basic housing, basic clothes, and ability to participate in culture, then you can actually calculate that all the in the administration, you need around, like, okay,
right.
You, did you act correctly, and did you pay your unemployment insurance and all that? If you take that away, it's almost there.
Right, right. Well, that's why I said the economic argument for it, that it's less administrative cost to give people, you know.
Right, but that's very hard, but you need to put the human basic rights in there.
We never signed
we
it.
Should, or we think we need to as a society, but we're not.
We did not.
And then the other part is also, if you go into the justice thing and in the current system, the people who really gain, they don't actually pay what they take off this earth. So, like, if you drive a car, you don't pay for climate change costs.
Mm-hmm.
So, and there is a school of thought that you should try to make them pay and then redistribute for what you take to make that more fair. And that could also help us go where we need to go. But I'm not sure that's really working, because the ones that profit from it are the dominant ones, and that might be the ones that can decide what they pay.
Okay, so we're doing great. Let's get into threes for a minute, right?
Sorry.
It's okay. It's okay. Let's get into threes and kind of talk about what are you know, some more responses and questions to this. And we especially want to hear from folk that like heard what we said and are disturbed by it, right? So get into threes, like get together and talk a little bit, and then we'll have some time for discussion.
It's one of those where we younger generations it's interesting to see what
so we have some
things that actually
I'm
going to go to more of an opportunity.
Regardless of what you're doing, and just that interaction.
the blindness and the choice that's given to us, like we've been talking about. No one can give it to us, and no one can take it from us. And so whatever we feel we need to do is not.
I'm in medical school, but we learned a bit about Maslow's hierarchy of needs. So, you know, you have your basic needs, food, shelter, etc. Then the needs get more and more specialized, like your need for, you know, education and higher purposes, and, you know, but you can't ever, you know, try and achieve higher purposes if your basic needs are not even met. Like, you're in a daily struggle of survival, so why would you care about the future or the environment or anything, except that I need food and I need shelter. And I just think that you hit the nail on the head today. Like, if there was a basic income, or people didn't have to worry about their daily survival, we could all just be more conscious of the environment, you know, and we could actually attain a higher purpose and live a more sustainable life. But the only way to achieve that is when the meaning system changes and we all just, like we were talking about how Holden Village is a bit of a haven. Here, money is not God. Here, like, God is God. So people volunteer. They're not so interested in the pursuit of wealth. They get food, they get shelter. And we just get to live a higher purpose in a more meaningful way. So we need to sort out the Maslow's hierarchy. We need to establish the basics so we can challenge this felt right.
So, yeah.
I was just going to say that, and that, you know, in our society, we haven't even said as a society, unlike in Europe and other places, that part of human rights is right to those things. I mean, that we have not signed the Human Rights Convention, you know. And so we have not, I mean, that's really, that's really important, that our society as a society, you know, has refused at a policy level to say that people have a right to eat, to be sheltered, and so forth. So that's a struggle that we have in this society to say, you know, those are human rights. And, you know, there was a lot of work around that years ago, but we haven't, you know, I mean, Anita probably didn't even know that about the United States.
I was shocked.
Yeah. Because I'm from Minnesota, I read the book, Hubert Humphrey was so into that, and he talked about measles and how we all have these basic needs. I was also thinking, too, you know, maybe it's the younger generation that's going to save us in some way. Looking seven generations down the road, you know, we really need to look at our environment. And I remember years ago, I was sitting in a Life magazine photo essay, and you talked about the whale situated, the orca, and respecting all God's creatures. So an elephant dies. This, of course, is in Africa. And the other members of the group hung around, and before the animal died, they got on either side of this elephant and tried to get it to stand. They didn't want to lose this elephant. And then they mourned for a long time. And it was such a powerful photo essay that has stuck with me. And, you know, these animals that we kill at random or whatever on safari.
And so that story of the parable of the talents, in many respects, all of us, I mean, I'll just say for myself, in many respects, I benefit from a system where I am the master.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Where I'm externalizing the waste, and I'm reaping benefit. Because I participate in it and benefit from a system that exploits the earth and its future, that exploits those in other parts of the world, and exploits the labor of those who've not received a wage increase for 50 years. I would say that what we see happening around us right now, in terms of the breakdown of our society, in terms of the reduction of people heading to churches or mosques or synagogues, the loneliness epidemic, all of these things are interconnected with the fact that there's tremendous wealth and income inequality in the country. And then we do have to deal with this notion of what does it mean to have what do you need to have a fulfilled life? What do you eat? And how do you get rid of stuff? Yeah.
Our group started talking about, I met Robert yesterday, what's his name? And what do you do? And where do you live? Which are all pretty system-oriented, perhaps with the exception of name. But where do you live, what do you do? Those are really system-oriented. What questions upon meeting somebody new could we ask that would break into something new?
What questions could we ask to break into something new?
So when we meet somebody,
when we,
you know, because what I hear you saying, Colleen, is that when we ask people, we're asking for their rank and identity, you know, where they are at in the pyramid of the market's hierarchy of importance, right? Yeah. And you're asking the question, what could we ask differently?
Who are you?
Yeah, because people usually, when they introduce themselves, they say, my name's Adam, I'm a banker or a doctor or an accountant or whatever.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, I think that on one hand, you could go in the direction of saying, we should ask something that maybe reveals more of their values. But I actually, and maybe this is just sort of my sort of, I think the Hebrew word, which is sort of like annoying, but annoying nature is that, what if we ask people how much money they made? Because I think that that's what we, because then you cut through. You cut through it, and that's, I mean, as a rabbi, for example, in my congregation, how much money do you make? Like, let's be real about what's going on here. And what's going on here is that some people have a lot more and are hoarding. You know, in the Torah, we have a story about the guy who picks up sticks on the Sabbath and the punishment is getting stoned to death. We don't actually do that. But why have such a horrible punishment for someone who's picking up sticks on the Sabbath? Why is that such a violation? It's because he is taking advantage. When the rest of the society has a contract saying no one's working on the Sabbath, if you go and then pick up sticks, you're picking up sticks that other people were agreeing not to pick up. Therefore, you have more than others, and you can start to exert control and power over other people. And that's why it was a violation worthy of death, because it's such a violation to extract that kind of power over other people. So if someone lets you know that their income is greater than their expenses, you know something about them that's really important. Now, you could ask them, like, you know, where is your favorite place to, you know, commune with divinity? And that's a powerful question, too. But it doesn't cut through the problem of our society, which is income inequality, and that we allow for people to hoard and feel not only okay about it, but good about it. And there's also, and it's impolite to point it out. That feels ridiculous to me.
The Chinese actually ask you that question, like, as a second or third question, who you are, where you from, how much money do you make?
So they
actually do ask you, and you need to somehow get your Western mind around that and how you answer.
Where Carrie and I are from, the question would be, how many combines do you run?
That's right. We're from the same hometown.
We were talking about, I mean, I think in along the lines of, we're using 1.7 Earths a year, and we know that we can't do that forever. And so, to some extent, doomsday is approaching. And what can our religions do? I mean, we all have stories. The Quran has wonderful guidance on stewardship of the earth, but that message has kind of been subsumed by our economic message. How can our religions help turn that tide before doomsday is upon us?
Wow.
I know. Not an easy question.
Let's answer that for all time, like we usually do.
Go for it. We're waiting on you, Adam. So I just say, I think part of we have to understand that the reason that the end of the world, you know, crowd amongst Christians, that Jesus is coming to destroy a world near you very soon, and that there are certain stepping stones that have to be put in place for that to happen. Including setting our Jewish neighbors up for destruction, loving them enough to get them to, right? I mean, there's terrible things in that theology, including the fact that the earth is a rental unit slated for destruction, and so break out the hammer and have a fun time smashing stuff up. Christians who do not see the world that way, do not read Revelation that way, read Scripture that way, need to stand up and be louder. But we have to understand the reason that our voices are not heard as much is because there are millions of dollars being spent to keep TV preachers who say that on the air all the time. And so people who are progressive and liberal need to stop eating our children and help to promote messages that give I believe, a more faithful view. And we get so competitive as liberals and progressives about, we're unwilling to join together and to put people forward into the media. And that's so short-sighted. So there's what Barbara Rossing says and has said in this space mm-hmm. is that the reason the end of the world whole fascination is happening is so that people can justify their consumerism mm-hmm. because my actions don't matter to the future,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
So, yes, ma'am.
So that's my question: is what do the each faith, if you could address, if you have the ability in your teachings and your understanding of them, what do, how does God speak to that in your traditions, each of you? Limits. What does God say about limits?
Well, I was going to answer both. I can answer both questions, which is that, you know, religions, and especially Judaism and Christianity and Islam, have evolved over time and have not been shy about telling people how to live their lives. I think that that would be a truism about all of them, is we you know, that the religious objective is to tell people how to live. Mm-hmm. So we're good at that. Mm-hmm. So it's time to start telling people how to live. Mm-hmm. You know, is that this is, you know, we have to change our ways. We're good at that. I mean, that's exactly what religion's been saying for a long time. You have to change your ways. You're going to have to turn this around. Only we can turn this around by changing our actions. That's something that is very preachable. But preaching it from a place of, and you're going to have to sacrifice, I think means going back also and maybe also, what was the original point of sacrifice in the Abrahamic tradition? And it was to acknowledge our place in the world and giving gratitude for the abundance. And so what will sacrifice mean now for us means probably doing with less so that others can exist at all. We're primed for it. You know, I think that the Abrahamic faiths are primed to be leaders worldwide in this effort to bring health back to the planet. In part, also, we're accountable, because I do think that there's a lot of notions embedded within the Abrahamic tradition that have led to this, like having dominion over the earth being taking the hammer and smashing it, as opposed to having responsibility for the planet.
For
so,
stewarding it.
For stewarding it, exactly. And being, you know, and also taking advantage of each other and not having so many of our systems are set up for us not to take advantage of each other, and yet you see even within it, like payday lending is a good issue, you know, that Jews and Christians and Muslims can all get behind, mm-hmm. is that that's a bad thing. Mm-hmm. That's probably one of the issues I'd say is strongest in our country for interfaith advocacy are issues like payday lending, but it could be the environment.
Mm-hmm. What is payday lending?
Payday lending is, it's a, it's so horrible, I can't even just...
We'll talk to you about it.
It's terrible.
Okay. Well,
it's another way to take advantage of poor people in our country.
Yeah, so to answer the question about what our faiths say, I guess that's what my presentation was really about. It was about what the general principles of the earth being a trust and of us being stewards of the earth. And so that responsibility is definitely there, even if the day of judgment is coming, then plant the seed. So you're not, like Terry was saying, trying to consume the earth because it's all going to disappear anyway. But rather, you want to give it back to God in a better situation than when you came upon it, right? So I think that's really what it's about.
And you teach that as an imam. Is it heard? Is it lived upon by the people that you shepherd?
I don't know what everyone does in their homes, but... I try to talk about these things all the time. In my people ask, what do you talk about in your sermons? I talk about racism and the environment and being thankful and not wasting and those kinds of things.
Cool.
Yeah.
I mean, how many Lutheran pastors, after their sermons are done, good sermon, pastor, and then, Yes, sir.
I was going to make a comment about... What happens in Africa, the kind of hope that we have. When we talk of Holden Village, we had villages in Africa. I was brought up in a village.
Yes.
And later on, when I started working, there were villages in where we bought houses and we lived like a community. The ones that come to me from our discussion is what Jesus said, that the kingdom of God is for those who are children, so that we all should be like children. So I remember that in one of the communities where I lived, men were not talking a lot, women were not talking a lot, but children were interacting. Children would pray with one another. It didn't matter whether the child was a Christian or a Muslim. They would come together, pray together, and as parents, we would hear from them. I happened to be the chairman of the residents there. So children would come to me as the chairman from all walks. And I think there is hope because of the generation we are bringing up, because of the children, because they have not been spoiled by a lot of things that have come to us as mature people. And if we can empower the children, if we can strengthen the children, they can bring us together. Whatever they have is something that can bring the world together. So as we look at the future, it's good to empower our children and to follow our children and listen to them and see what they are doing. That they can have some hope for us so that the future can be bright. We have spent most of our years, children have not spent anything, they have more years and we can look forward to them.
Thank you.
I feel like one of the things that our partnership talked about was the importance of politics in all of this conversation. I know that getting religion and politics kind of intermeshed is kind of a tough topic sometimes because, you know, talking with your people who share your same faith or at least some of the same faith beliefs, it can be tough because not everyone shows that in the same way, I guess. But talking about income inequality, talking about caring for the environment, like I just keep going back to, well, if that's my faith belief, how am I going to change it? It's probably going to be through politics, you know? And thinking about that means also, I think for myself, even making some difficult decisions about where my wealth is going. You know, I have a pretty comfortable job as a teacher, and yet I have to think, okay, but I'm living in a house right now that has, you know, this many bedrooms, and I know families that I teach who are living in with, you know, extended family in two bedrooms, six people, and I just think, how is that equitable? How is that just? And it's not. And so I think that part of looking at basic income, looking at all of these things is going to mean that we have to talk with the people in our that share our similar faiths, talk with people who might not share our similar faiths and say, hey, you know, even though talking about politics is difficult, maybe we need to talk about having an income tax or maybe getting rid of some of the more regressive tax structures that especially Washington State has and putting in more progressive tax structures. And that's not an easy conversation. It's not a fun conversation. I don't want to tell someone they have to give the government more money. Like, you know, I don't think anybody thinks that's necessarily I don't think a lot of people think that's necessarily the best way to do things, but, you know, we have to do something. And I just look at those charts that you showed us, and I think, what do those charts correlate with any, you know, political decisions that have been made in the past 20, 30, 40, 50 years? And I think it's pretty clear that they definitely do. And so I think we just need to connect our faith with political advocacy as well and making sure that we're driving our congregations to the polls, that we're getting people involved in political action, in marches, in, you know, talking with their neighbors. And it's tough. And so I'm not sure exactly how we make that happen.
So a couple things, just a brief frame and then a quick response. There's partisan. It's very important that faith leaders and faith communities not be partisan, I think.
But say what you mean by that.
And what I mean by that is we're for the Democrats. The Democrats are awesome. You know, God has come down and blessed the Democrats. God has come down and blessed the Republicans with all that is right and holy. That's like not helpful. There's political. The word political has to do, it comes from a Greek word that means how we order the city. Comes from really from the word city. So how do we order a community? It's vital that we talk about that issue. Because as I argued the other day, the Abrahamic faith tradition is a critique of cultures and how they organize themselves to advantage very few and disadvantage most people, and to say that the people who are disadvantaged are sinners. We call people who are poor, we call them the poor. They're not the poor. They are people who are poor. We call homeless people, but they're not homeless people. There are people who are homeless. They are made in the image. So our language, we label people as economic sinners who have deserved what they have not gotten. if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So second, Deutsche Bank said that changing tax structures is one of the influences in wealth, inputs into wealth and inequality. And lastly, we're not giving the government money. Okay, so what's the founding document of this nation? What does it say? What does it start out?
We the people.
So we're giving we the people the money to thrive, not only now, but into the future. So you guys want to say something about that?
It's the potential to get the money.
There's a gentleman up there in the corner who's been very patient, and we want to honor him.
Yes. What I'm hearing is we all need to care for the earth and each other and share it. And my prayer life is not what it should be. I think what I can do personally, what I'm deciding to do today, is whenever I commune with nature, go on a hike, visit the shore, whatever, is to touch the earth and to audibly thank the Creator for it and promise to care of it the best I can.
Amen.
Amen.
And that's where it starts.
The purpose of our faith practices is to create that kind of awareness.
Gratitude.
Yeah. Yes, ma'am.
One thing that we talked about in regards to the ecosystem was like repairing clothing or repairing, you know, waffle iron or things that break down or growing our own food, you know, buying food at the farmer's market or whatever. But as I've been sitting here post our discussion and thinking about, we are privileged enough to be able to buy clothes that are worth repairing or waffle iron that's worth repairing or have property onto which we can grow food or afford to shop at the farmer's market. But what do we say to those people who don't have that basic income about, you know, they need to get the cheapest disposable clothing because that's the only thing they can afford. They need to get the cheapest fast food because that's the only thing they can eat, despite the fact of the impact on the earth of those kinds of decisions or get the cheapest thing. What do I say to those that don't have the luxury of having, you know, being able to afford those kinds of practices that are more ecologically sound? Not everyone has that option. What do we do there?
We have to recognize that the institutions and structures within which we live impact all of us far more profoundly than impact our poor neighbors and all, but all of us, our neighbors who have less wealth, more profoundly than our personal care for them. Which means that part of our issue in the United States is that we conceive of everybody as a free market individual with equal power. And the individuals are the only unit that matters. And part of what the Abrahamic tradition is saying, no, community matters. Mm-hmm. Other people matter. We are in this together. Mm-hmm. And that should lead us to redouble our efforts, not to blame those who have to go to McDonald's to get the inexpensive meal protein for the bodies of their children to grow, but rather to work on the doing everything we can in solidarity and in partnership with them, like happens at the Faith Action Network, to try to shift the political conversation for a more sustainable, just, and equitable society. What do you all?
I mean, I think if there was a carbon tax, then a lot of those things that seem to be very cheap would become more expensive, and then people would be forced to find other ways. And so, for example, a part of it is education. I mean, a lot of times people just don't know. A lot of times it's much easier, and I've read stories of people that kind of changed their lives and how they came out of poverty. Is people just don't know. They just don't have education about. A lot of times they feel like a cheeseburger is easier to buy and consume, but pasta is much cheaper, but you have to cook it and you have to put that time. They don't have the resources all the time, but for them to know what resources are available to them, for them to be able to take advantage of those things, I think providing that training, providing that education, providing that financial acumen that a lot of times people who have that education, have those finances, they have that that understanding of how best to make use of their money. A lot of times, people who are poor or people who are homeless don't have that education. So just sharing that time with them, sharing that knowledge with them, I think is also something that could be done.
So it's 12, okay, and all conversations must come to an end. And this is a big topic. I just want to say that I have so enjoyed learning from my sister, Johanna, my Rabbi Johanna, and from Imam Adam. Mm-hmm. I've so enjoyed that and learning with all of you. And thank you for coming to our sessions. And may God bless all of us. Thank you. Have an amazing night.